You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio.
It is extraordinary what we hide from ourselves, and even more extraordinary that we once hid her, my mother's sister, and so many like her from everyone. Here are all these pictures of nonverbal children, so pulsingly alive, their parents describing their pleasures, their passions, their strengths and styles and tastes. Well, I know nothing, absolutely nothing, of my aunt's life at all. She is a thinning shadow, an aging ghost. Strange how seldom we think about who our parents were as people before we made their acquaintance, all the dynamics and influences that shaped them, the defining traumas and triumphs of their early lives, and show them compassion and understanding as they age. I was 12 when I learned. My mother and I were sitting at the kitchen table when I wondered aloud what I would do if I'd ever had a disabled child. This provided her with an opening. Her name is Adele.
That's Jennifer Senior, staff writer at The Atlantic. Listeners of this podcast might remember her from a previous bonus episode in which we discussed her remarkable Atlantic cover story, What Bobby McIlvaine Left Behind, for which she won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for Feature Writing. Now she's back to talk about her latest Atlantic cover story, in which she excavates her own family secret in a piece called Those We Sent Away. Jennifer had an aunt, her mother's younger sister, who was sent away to a mental institution as a young child. This is a story that many families share, one of hiddenness, shame, and silence that casts an invisible net over generations. I'm Danny Shapiro, and this is a special bonus episode of Family Secrets. The secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves. My first question is, you were 12 when you learned, but if you look back, was there anything that you felt was there sort of hovering in the air in your family's home, or anything that, you know, obviously supplying retrospect and knowledge to this, but still, where you would say there was a sense that there was something that you didn't know?
I have thought about this. And like you said, there is this huge temptation to sort of assign in retrospect, like, oh, yes, of course, I was aware of this, and now it all makes sense. But there are two things that I wrote about that did, of course, immediately lock into place, which was that my grandfather volunteered at the Westchester Association for Retarded Citizens. We don't use the word retarded anymore. We should not. But that's what it was called at the time. And, oh, of course, he was trying to parent in a daily way and directly. This is all he did every day of his retirement because his daughter was not living with him. So that made sense. my grandmother running off to the local department store and buying Christmas presents when we were Jewish suddenly made sense, because my aunt was taken to church and every Sunday and only understood Christmas. I think something else that may have locked into place was, oh, so my grandparents did want more kids. I knew there was something sort of unusual about my mom being the one and only. Like, there was never any good explanation for this. It's very rare to come across only baby boomers, right? Like, that's not a thing. And my grandparents were young when they had her. I guess in hindsight, one thing I will say is that my mother's perfectionism and her control, and I read about this, but it had some other explanation, right? That maybe she really did feel this immense pressure to be good enough for two, because her own grandmother very artlessly said to her one day, "You have to be good enough for two. Your parents lost a child."
I was very struck by that detail. The your great-grandmother, who you refer to as, you know, she meant well, I suppose, and had all the subtlety of a fly swatter. And, you know, your mother's 13 years old, and your great-grandmother tells her that she had to be good enough for two children, smart enough for two children. And your great-grandmother is, on the one hand, telling your mother something.
Right, which was a gift, because my mother was in the dark. My great-grandmother was truly the first person to explain to her what had happened. Like, that was, in some weird way, its own perverse gift. I mean, it wasn't perverse. My great-grandmother leveled with her. She was the first person to say, "This is what happened. You know, you have a profoundly retarded sister." That was the terminology of the day. She was institutionalized. It was a family of secrets. No one came through the front door and said this. And then she laid this immense burden on her.
Right. And also the burden, I mean, your mother was told that her sister had gone away first to, quote unquote, walking school, because she was severely delayed in terms of her ability to walk. And then, you know, when is she coming back? We don't know. And this was very much something that happened in that time. And, you know, you write about that so beautifully in your story. But writing about medical professionals saying it's better if people don't know, the instinct to protect the family, the child from knowledge, but in fact, it's there. Your mother was working overtime to try to figure out where her sister had gone. What was the age difference between them?
4.5 years. I mean, nearly five.
So your mom is a five-year-old. There's a baby sister. That's the most wonderful thing in the whole world. And as far as your mother was concerned, this was her sister who she adored and could do no wrong. It was perfect. And there was no reason to think anything otherwise, because whatever your grandparents were going through was being done quietly and a kind of, you know, keeping it from your mother, you know, keeping it from the child, which was what happened across the board in those days. But it leaves the child in that situation is not knowing what's up, what's going on, and sort of attempting to put together pieces of a puzzle.
Yes. I mean, and the question is whether it was even that active. What I wonder about, like, how hard was she actively trying to piece this together? Or was it more like that she walked around in something between a fog of bewilderment, punctuated by stretches of overwhelming pain? You know, she would sort of, because at first, as you point out, and as I say, you know, she didn't have any inkling that anything was different about her sister. How could she? A five-year-old knows nothing. And for the first year of my aunt's life, the doctors were insisting, the pediatrician insisted that nothing was different about her. So it took an outside pediatrician to even look at my aunt and bluntly declare to my grandmother that she was, and this is a direct quote, a microcephalic idiot, right? My aunt had just turned about one, and from that moment on, my grandparents were doing a frantic circuit of all of the city's specialists trying to figure out what could be done. But my mother was kept out of this, and all my mother knew was that there was an adorable baby girl in the playpen in the living room or in the crib in her parents' bedroom, and that she had special responsibilities vis-a-vis this, her little baby sister. She had to go in and see if she was napping. She'd keep my grandmother company as she was making bottles. She invented games to play with her while she was in her crib. I mean, what 5.5-year-old or 6-year-old or 6.5-year-old is going to have any understanding of developmental milestones in a child? Like, they're just not. So this all caught her totally by surprise when one day my grandparents said, "We're taking Adele to walking school." But I think at first she just went, "Oh, okay, walking school. I guess that's a thing." But, as the months drag by and she keeps saying, "Well, when's she coming home?" And then as the years drag by and she one day got hysterical and said, "How long can it possibly take for Adele to learn how to walk?" This was about 1.5 years in. And my grandparents, I mean, there were no books to consult. There was no language for them to recruit from to explain to my poor mother what was going on. I didn't look at my mother and say, "How actively were you trying to piece this together? Like, how aggressive were you in your sleuthing?" You know, my mother, every time she mentions it, first of all, it's very pained. And second of all, there's so much confusion in her voice when she relives it for me, that it just sounds to me, frankly, like it was very, very overwhelming. And also that she sensed on some level that asking the question was causing her parents pain. And I think she intuited early on that this is a painful subject and I'm going to be a good kid. I'm not going to create any trouble. I am going to behave impeccably. And even before my great-grandmother very clumsily said to her, "You have to be good enough for two, you have to be perfect for two," I think even before that, my mother probably had some sense that she was going to stand sideways and get out of the way.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating, first of all, what children are capable of absorbing without necessarily knowing or consciously knowing or certainly intellectually knowing. You know, we talk a lot on this podcast about the phrase, psychoanalytic phrase, the unthought known, that mm-hmm. which is so dangerous to think that you never actually think it, but on some deep level, you know it. And, you know, you used a phrase a little while ago, the fog of bewilderment. And, you know, that makes so much sense to me, that fog, and that's what you're describing. In a way, you know, I don't know, but I would doubt that your mother ever sort of sat down and had a little talk with herself at age 9 or 10 or 7 of, you know, "I'm going to be a good girl." But she internalized that memo.
I think that's right. And I think if you want to go to the unthought known, the question is like, okay, if this is, if my grandparents felt like what they had to do, because it's a source of shame to have a child like this, right? It means that either there's something wrong with your genes, it's some kind of religious punishment, right? Whatever it is, for whatever reasons, and also, you know, it's the 1950s, there's some imperative to assimilate. Among Jews, there was probably a double imperative to assimilate. My guess is that, like, what did they do? They nailed this beneath the floorboards, right? So for my own mom, what was scratching underneath the floorboards of her consciousness, right? Like, what unthought known was there, right? Like, she probably on some level knew something. She had to. I mean, she did have other families to compare her own to. And I just found out from my mother's first cousin that somebody else in their family was pregnant at around the same time as my grandmother. I wish I'd known this before I wrote the story. It kind of kills me that I didn't. But someone else in the family was pregnant at the same time, and they gave birth at practically the same time. And that little girl was born and grew up in a perfectly kind of typical trajectory, right? Hitting all the milestones and all the beats, never left the house. My mother must have put something together. And at some point, the kids in the neighborhood were gossiping and being cruel and saying, "I heard that your sister was at reform school," right? Like, so who knows what kind of I didn't ask her about the unthought known either. It's funny. I was getting my own cues from my mother about what was safe to ask. Truly. It's not that I'm not a thoroughgoing, interlocutor or, I ask a lot of questions, but like, I obviously was like being very delicate with my own mom when I was talking to her.
Well, it makes perfect sense. I mean, it struck me that there's, first of all, a really kind of uncanny parallel age-wise from when she found out,
you
were 12 when you learned, and you asked the right question. I mean, or you it wasn't really a question. You were musing about what you would ever do if you were to have a disabled child, and it was like a seam opened, within your mother at that particular moment, and she just said it. And that's somewhat different from whatever dam burst in your great-grandmother to have said that to your mother. But you do find that out at the same age. And there also is, I think, that feeling of where there's great pain in a family, or a child senses that about a parent, including a grown child sensing that about a parent. There's this delicacy or this feeling of, I love you and I don't want to cause you pain, so I'm not going to go there. So for instance, when you go with your mother to visit Adele, I don't think it was the first time that you went, but the more recent time, because you were going both as a daughter and a niece and a reporter. The first time you were a daughter and a niece and just wanted to see for yourself what was,
I was only 28.
Right. Yes. So, but this time you had your recorder on, and one of the things that you note in your piece is how much silence there was in the car.
Yep. So much silence. And also so much, I would have said, not denial, but God, what would be the right word? Deflection? Maybe? That's a very, very astute thing to home in on, and it's like the perfect transition. Because exactly, there I am, we have a 90-minute car ride, and my mother at any point can be like, wow, I wonder what this is going to be like. I have not seen her in 21 years, and I've only seen her 3 times ever in my adult life. My mom went 40 years without seeing her sister again. She went from age 6 to age 46. And then saw her only 3 times, not particularly successfully. The visits were awkward. My aunt was living in a different group home at the time. So this is a brand new group home. And she's not wondering a lot about, in fact, not only is she not wondering a lot about this, she is talking about something else entirely. She is telling me all about the new necklace making project that she has embarked on. And I am kind of sitting there in disbelief, and my tape recorder is running, and it's got a lot of I eventually turned it off because it's just stuff about necklaces, right? It was crazy. I only had about 15 minutes of conversation with her about this, right? And so I have always known, and I was very nervous about asking my mom whether to do this, right? I said to her, you don't have to come with me. I just really want to meet her. I really want to see her. I want to write about her. I hope this is okay. Please don't feel like just because I want to go, it means that you have to go. I understand that you have all of these reasons that you have decided that you are going to, I don't judge at all the kind of decisions you've made around this. This is like a defining trauma for you as a kid. But, and she surprised me by being very open to it and saying, no, let's go. Let's go together. Almost like some part of her, I thought, wanted it. But then when we got in the car, I thought, no part of her wants this. I think she was just this portrait of ambivalence, right? And it made the reporting really odd, and really hard. And I think it's one of the reasons that, I did it as a reporter, because I felt emboldened to ask slightly more challenging questions.
We'll be right back.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, it strikes me that your mother, once she knew as a 13-year-old, and also once the sort of whisper campaign that must have always been there, that game of telephone that happens in suburban neighborhoods or all neighborhoods or among all people.
Well, this is in Flatbush. We're talking about a serious city neighborhood. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so eventually the kids are cruel. And your mother begins to tell people that she's an only child. And it just strikes me that the work emotionally and psychologically that had to go into, you know, the heartbreak of that. This is what I'm going to say, and this is how I'm going to live. This is how I'm going to live my life moving forward, because there didn't really seem to be any other option. And so then all of these years later, there she is, you know, in the car driving with you. And yeah, she's talking about necklaces. Because it's like the 13-year-old saying, I'm an only child. The degree to which we have to work over time to put something that won't be easily boxed up in a box or under the floorboards, as you say, and the courage that it takes to confront it, which it struck me reading your piece and the sort of trajectory that emotionally that your mother goes through over the course of the story, it reaches a point where it is no longer in any way, Adele is not in a box for her anymore. Adele is not a person with a diagnosis, a person who was sent away and who isn't able to recognize her own parents, her own sister. It becomes something else entirely.
Well, my mother said something very interesting to me at one point, which is that she was led to believe that Adele was so intellectually compromised that she was essentially a vegetable. That's almost verbatim what my mother said to me. And so I think it was almost giving her permission to say, I don't have a sister. My sister is not sentient, you know, in the way that you can like make the decision, oh, if somebody's a vegetable, you know, like end-of-life care, like why would we want to, you know, sustain some? I mean, I really think on some level, that is the way my mother was trained to think about her. Even though what's fascinating is that she had plenty of evidence to the contrary. She saw this little girl who was scooching around in her own playpen following her when my mother, you know, well, as my mother shouted, here, baby. Adele would scooch to different corners of the crib and smile or acknowledge her. So Adele was plenty interactive, or certainly interactive enough, Yet at some point, she allowed that story, a different story, to kind of become the story. And my God, I don't think she was a 13-year-old when she told people she was an only child. I think it was starting from the time she was like 6.5 or 7. Her sister gets sent away, and being completely bewildered by it, when people started asking, she just said, "I'm an only child," because no one else was in the house. And my suspicion is that my grandparents encouraged her to say it. You know, the only question somebody asked me this recently, and I was embarrassed to not know the answer. It was a great question. I can't believe I didn't think to ask my mother. In my grandmother's obituary, how many kids does it say she has? And my grandmother was not a person of any note. I'm sure the obituary that ran was the little squib that you pay for, right, in the New York Times or in the local paper. And I'm sure my mom paid for the squib. And it would have been my mom who was in charge. And the question is, what decision would my mom would have made? Would she have said that my grandmother had one kid or two? And I sat there, like, completely unable to answer that question. For the life of me, I could not tell you. Years ago, when she saw her sister with her mother, when she was already in her 40s, and it was like the first time she saw her sister as an adult, 40 years later, she came home and she wrote like this little mini essay for herself saying, "I have a sister." And I asked her, "Why did you write that? Was it because it was almost like this sense of unreality and you just wanted to make it real?" And she said, "I wanted to admit it to myself. This is some secret that I had been hiding for all these years." She used the word admit, which I think is so fascinating. You know, like it was a confession of some kind.
To herself, in a way. I mean, the tagline for this show is, the secrets we keep, the secrets that are kept from us, and the secrets we keep from ourselves. And I always find the most fascinating, strange, uncanny, resonant kind of secrets the ones that we are somehow able to keep from ourselves until we no longer can.
That was what she did. I mean, she had this clandestine sibling, you know, and it was, she was keeping this knowledge from herself. I think on some level, in order to function. I mean, I think it must have been too hard to process otherwise. She told me something very interesting that I had for a long time in my story and then ultimately cut because she was so ambivalent about it. But for your show and for you, just because you're so psychoanalytically inclined, you'll find this whole internal debate that she had about it fascinating. She said to me that when she was in psychoanalysis in her early 20s, my mom, her psychoanalyst said to her, "Do you think that as a child, you walked around in terror that if you did anything wrong, you would also be sent away, that you would also be sent to the equivalent of walking school if your grades weren't good enough or if you didn't hit a particular milestone, if you were clumsy in sports, if you were this for you or that, you know, would you have been sent away?" And I grew up with my mother telling me that she believed this, that she thought that, like, if she wasn't good enough, she'd be sent away, that she labored under this misapprehension. And I brought this up with her in the car, and she said, "Oh, you know what? I think my shrink was wrong about that. I think my psychoanalyst was wrong. I don't really think so. I don't think I was a perfectionist for that reason. It probably had much more to do with, like, what Nanny said to me, you know, that she told me that I had to be good enough for two, but I don't think I ever really feared that I'd be sent away. But maybe her psychoanalyst was right." I mean, I don't know. You know, my mother is clearly not sure. At some point when I was younger, that was the story I was told by her. But she recanted it when I, you know, asked her in the car. She thought that her psychoanalyst's hypothesis was right. And she didn't even present it to me when I was a young woman as her psychoanalyst's hypothesis. She said, "So, you know, I had this sister who was sent away, and so I was deathly afraid when I was a kid that if I did anything wrong, I would be sent away." And when I brought this up with her in the car, she said, "Oh, I'm not sure that's true. It was my psychoanalyst who came up with this as an idea, and I think he just put it in my head. And it sounded very tidy, and it sounded very plausible, but you want to know what? I'm not sure it's right."
I mean, in the absence of, you know, actual fact-checkable knowledge. These are narratives that we can supply, right? So for a period of time in her life, that was the narrative she supplied.
Correct.
And then later in her life, it became, no, I don't think that was it, which seems very right to me in terms of the way that our stories and our memories and our relationship to whatever the, you know, to whatever is at hand shifts and changes over the course of our lives.
Absolutely.
This was, from the standpoint of what we understand today, just shockingly common in the 1940s, probably 1950s, 1960s. If a family had a child who was severely disabled intellectually, you know, and or physically, that they would be sent away and there were and never spoken of again and erased. And there were famous examples of people who did this, ranging from the Kennedys to Arthur Miller and Pearl S. Buck. This was what was considered the thing that you did. And some families dealt with that as a secret differently than others, or the secret sort of comes out in certain, I mean, Arthur Miller never wanted to write about it, never wanted to talk about it. It was, but
and never visited.
And never visited. And Pearl S. Buck ends up writing about it in her memoir. She writes, "I felt as though I were bleeding inwardly and desperately." So Pearl Buck faces head on at a certain point just the absolute agony of you know, what it is to institutionalize a child. And so it ranges, but I think what all of the families of that time of sort of post-war America, and as you say, the shame of having a child who is severely disabled, there's just this feeling that this is what you do, and the doctors and their white coats and their certainty and the way that doctors were seen at that time as being godlike. So one of the things that I'm wondering about, your piece begins with your husband telling you to read this tweet that went viral. And the tweet is by someone who he writes about his son, who is his 25th birthday. He's never said a word in his life, but has taught me so much more than I've ever taught him. And this tweet goes viral, and your husband points it out to you, and you're scrolling through and you're reading some stuff, but it doesn't occur to you right away why you're going down the rabbit hole, other than, wow, this is really interesting that this tweet went viral. And I find that so fascinating that it took you a bit, right, to realize why your husband had pointed out that tweet to you and why you were immersed in the story.
So one important thing to point out, the reason it went viral is because there was a lot to read in response to the tweet. What happened was that tweet unleashed this outpouring from parents all over the world of pictures of their own nonverbal or minimally verbal children. So that what I was scrolling through was picture after picture after picture of these beautiful kids, some young, some old, some full-fledged adults, tweeted by their much older parents or their siblings. And some were joyous, and some were goofy, and some were silly, and some were serious, and some were badass. I mean, they really ranged, these pictures. But what they all had in common is that, like, the kids were all super characterful, right? They were all just these pulsingly alive portraits. And, yeah, it is weird, because like everyone in my family, I had been trained to sort of not think about this. It took me about a half an hour of scrolling before I went, oh my God, there is somebody in my family who meets this exact description. And the difference is that I don't know her and I don't have a single picture of her. Nothing. And there's been no pictures that I've ever seen of her. And in fact, when we had to find art for this story, the art department was saying, do you have any pictures of her from when she was a baby or anything? My mother didn't think she had a single picture of Adele. And lo and behold, there was one of my grandparents and her, and it's in the story. It's the only thing there.
Yeah, I've been staring at it while we're talking.
Yeah. I mean, it's And like, and what's so interesting about it is like, my grandmother looks so impeccably turned out. She's got her, you know, her Sunday best on. I mean, she's got the hat and the nylons and the lipstick, you know. And her and my grandfather look very happy and relaxed with, you know, Adele in the middle. And what you were saying, too, about that wide range. I mean, my grandparents visited her every weekend. They didn't just sort of send her away. My grandparents had fallen in love with their child and were shattered to be told that the best thing for her was to be put, you know, in an institution. That was, and the justification was always, it's not just that it wasn't just that it was best for your family. It was that it was best for the remaining sibling, which, looking at my mother, I mean, it would have been very hard to have somebody like Adele around, but I don't know whether it was best for her. It's, I think, an open question. There certainly wasn't the infrastructure to sort of take care of Adele. It would have taken a lot of work on the part of the family, and they didn't have any money. They couldn't have outsourced this, but her care, you know, they couldn't have had round-the-clock custodial care, which Adele may have needed. But they also said that it was best for Adele, which it most certainly was not. This was this, like, gothic mansion of horrors. I mean, it was terrible, Willowbrook, where she was ultimately institutionalized. But if you're going to look at the broad spectrum of, like, people in denial, you know, who never saw their kids and never talked about them, like Arthur Miller, to people like Pearl S. Buck, who very bravely wrote about their children. And by the way, her memoir, she wrote a whole memoir that was just about that. It wasn't a memoir about her life. She wrote a memoir only about having a child. It was about that, called The Child Who Never Grew. And it was about the pain of institutionalizing her. And she waited until she was nine. And when she was in Japan, everybody thought, like, what? You're going to put her in an institution? Nobody there did that. Americans did that.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole other subject. I mean, that makes me wonder about the nature of how we think of family, or how we think of generations and
well, we do it with our elderly, right? I mean,
exactly.
It's terrible.
We'll be back in a moment with more Family Secrets.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because, God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick, I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a wonderful photograph in your piece, just amazing, of your mother and Adele on the day of that visit, not the 1993 visit, but the visit when you're starting to report this piece in
2021.
Yep. Your mother has an N95 mask that she's pulled down so that you can see her face, and she and Adele are standing together. And on the one hand, they couldn't look more different. Adele is much smaller, and your mother looks like she could walk, you know, out the door and straight into, you know, lunch at, you know, a lovely right. restaurant, and Adele doesn't. But they're both wearing red sweaters, and they're both wearing the aforementioned beaded necklaces because each of them has gotten into beading.
At the exact same time.
Yeah, at the exact same time in their lives. And there also are so many other similarities between them. They both needlepoint. They both are neat freaks. They're both musical. And all of this kind of keeps on emerging. What did that feel like for you during that visit? You know, on the one hand, you have your reporter's hat on, and at the same time, you are a daughter and a niece and a member of a family who is experiencing this kind of amazing moment.
Yeah, I nearly died. I mean, do you remember that very famous New Yorker story about twins? And they were looking for the first time, I think it's the Minnesota twin study, where they were looking at trying to string apart nature and nurture and looking at twins who'd been separated. And there were all these stories of, like, you know, brothers who hadn't seen each other for 40 years and identical twins. And they'd meet up and they would both be wearing yellow Izod shirts, and they both had ex-wives named Gail. And, you know, I mean, I'm making this up, but, you know, nutty stuff like that. I felt a little bit like I was looking at that. Those darn necklaces, which were like the bane of my car ride, like, Mom stopped talking about the necklaces, suddenly that it becomes like the most salient thing, because there is Adele wearing a necklace that she's made while my mother has a necklace that she's made. And the first thing that we're shown in her bedroom is like the drawer full of all the necklaces she's recently been making, you know, and that's a photo illustration in the magazine. I mean, it kind of blew my doors off. You know, I couldn't believe what I was staring at. And that they both were wearing this bright red. The thing that really killed me, though, was that they're both musical. Like, okay, you know, my grandfather was in the Glee Club. There's a story about him, like, having been in the same Glee Club as, like, Frank Sinatra. You know, like, okay, so they're musical, right? Like, maybe that's in the family. Maybe there's, like, some kind of constellation of genes that code for that sort of thing. Even like being, you know, futzing with your hands, needlepointing and making necklaces, even that I can kind of grok. But the fact that they are neat freaks, like, on the one hand, I was like, okay. So I always assumed that my mom was highly controlled because she had been traumatized. And as a consequence, you know, she'd been deeply traumatized as a kid. Her sister gets spirited away, no explanation. It's not discussed. And my mother makes some unconscious decision for the rest of her life that she is going to control everything within her power, right? And then I meet Adele, and Adele wants to control everything within her power. And not only that, but they are controlling everything in the exact same way. It all revolves around the kitchen. If you get up to try and clear the dishes and bring them into the kitchen, my mother will like rush you out of the kitchen because she is the only one who knows how to load the dishwasher, and she is the only one who knows where things go. If you try and make a salad, she will start instructing you about the proper way to cut cherry tomatoes. My mother has like really fixed ideas about cherry tomatoes, you know, like she's got a cherry tomato philosophy. And, you know, I mean, so, and that is Adele. You know, like, glasses have to face a certain way, right? Like, just everything, nothing can be out of place. She gets very agitated if things are, like, not just so. And I thought, what? Is there, like, a protein coating for this? Like, what is going on? And I thought, okay, it must just be, like, it must just run in the family, right? Even though I don't remember my grandmother or my grandfather particularly being this way. And then the daughter of the woman who was, like, the mama bear in the house where Adele lived. And so the daughter says to me one day, she knows Adele very well, right? She knows all the residents of the house very well. She says to me, because I'm telling her, like, it's so weird that they're both neat freaks. I just assumed that my mom was, like, a neat freak because she was born of trauma. This is a trauma-related trait. And the daughter says to me, well, how do you know that Adele wasn't traumatized? Maybe it's born of the exact same thing. And I sat there in chastened silence for, like, 8 seconds. You can just hear 8 seconds of nothing on my tape recorder, right? Like, just me going, oh, yeah. Like, oh, my God. You know, because, of course, I am sure that all of those years of living in these hellish institutions, right? I mean, she lived in Willowbrook, which was exposed by Geraldo Rivera in 1972 as being just, and RFK visited it in 65 and called it a hellhole. It was just this horrible place. People rocking and wailing naked on the floor. Everybody under stimulus. It reeked of urine and feces. Not only unhygienic, it wasn't a school. It was built as a school. It wasn't a school. There was nothing there and nothing for the residents to play with, nothing for them to do all day. Only two, you know, attendants per, you know, floor for, like, you know, one person per 80 people or 50 people. You know, they were force-fed quickly. I mean, it was ghastly. Ghastly. And then my aunt was moved from there to a different institution, and it was just as bad and just as grim. And that's where my aunt lived. And I don't know what, I mean, in addition to just being underloved and underprotected and understimulated, she may have been physically abused. She may have been sexually abused. I mean, we don't know. We know nothing. She can't explain it or convey it. All we know is that every so often my aunt would say, stop that, you're hurting me. She would scream it. And they thought, all the doctors who were treating her thought, well, she must be psychotic. This is some kind of auditory hallucination. But why wasn't that just PTSD? Why wasn't she just re-experiencing trauma? You know, who knows? I mean, maybe she was just having, like, a horrific memory when she shouted stuff like that. These similarities between my mom, like the neatnik stuff, the control stuff, it might just be trauma-related stuff. I mean, I'm not a neatnik. I mean, I'm like the Oscar Madison to my mother's Felix. And by the way, just talking about the generational stuff, people were sent away right through the 70s. This continued. This just kept on going. It really wasn't until the 80s that people would even countenance the idea of keeping neurodiverse kids at home, and that the infrastructure first kind of became available where, you know, day programs were available, and where, I don't know, I think it was probably in the 90s that kids were mainstreamed into public schools. The public schools started taking them. I don't know when, but at some point the state started providing free occupational therapy and physical therapy and speech therapy. It took a long time for, you know, anything like the infrastructure to be born.
No, it's one of the ways I can count on one hand, you know, one of the ways that our world has improved. You know, I really want people to read your piece and not to tell the whole story of it, but there were no diagnoses. There was no sense that there could be or should be diagnoses. It was like one big basket of a catch-all for beyond hope, beyond redemption.
Or difficult, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, filled with some kind of panic or anger that can't be expressed, right? Something.
Right.
You know?
And that needs to be managed by sedation and by, sort of these extreme measures that make any kind of real developmental progress absolutely impossible. You know, and a really moving part of your story is that it occurs to you that you might be able to get an answer to what in fact was responsible, what mutation, what genetic mutation, what condition was responsible for Adele's being, you know, as developmentally impaired as she was. You do find out that she has a very, very rare genetic mutation. And at the time you discover this, there are only 12 people on record who have been diagnosed with this. And then, you know, over the course of even just your reporting this piece, there start to be more people diagnosed with it. The condition is called Coffin-Siris syndrome 12. And then you do something that I found so moving and so fascinating, which is you want to meet a kid, you know, someone growing up today, someone being raised in a very, very, as different from the way that Adele spent her life as is imaginable, and just see what the difference might be if a child is raised with all of the possible interventions and therapies at her disposal.
That's right. And it was positively bittersweet.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, Jen. I mean, there was this moment that was just like gutted me, which was after you've met this girl and her family, her mother, there's this line in your piece, which is, I thank Grace and Emma for the gifts and head out to my rental car. I last maybe 30 seconds before losing it.
This little girl was just outside Kansas City, and her parents adopted her. They had fostered her originally and then decided to adopt her. They'd fallen in love. My grandparents had fallen in love and done the opposite. They'd given their little girl away. And what is amazing is they hand me these presents, and then Emma gives me a picture for me to give to my aunt. And her mother, who's just this force of nature, looks at Emma and says, "Do you remember why you drew this picture for Jennifer? Do you remember why you drew a picture for her aunt?" And Emma, who, of course, because she's benefited from all of these early interventions, can speak in full sentences, unlike my aunt. And she says, "Oh, yes, it's because her aunt has trouble in school, like me." And her mother says, "That's right." And she says, "Do you know what her aunt has?" And what I thought she was going to say was, "She has Coffin-Siris syndrome 12, just like you." And that's not what her mother said. What her mother said was, she also has parents who couldn't take care of her, but found her a place where someone else can take care of her, just like you. And I just thought, but my grandparents could have taken care of her. If they had all the same resources at their disposal, not only could they have, they would have desperately wanted to, because they, like Pearl S. Buck, were bleeding inwardly and desperately. But they had no choice. They had to give her away. And they were being told to, for the good of the baby, for the good of my mother, for the good of the whole family, by all of these authoritative granite-faced doctors. And here's my grandma, a working-class woman, no college education, who just swallows hard and says, "Okay." I mean, it just killed me. It broke me into 1,000 pieces. I mean, I just sat in the car and started to bawl. You know, I mean, it just was so hard. I mean, and to his credit, you know, I told my editor about it. I told him about the moment, and he cut me off before I even finished it. And he said, "How long did you last before you burst into tears?" How unfair is all of this? You know, you weep for everyone involved. For my aunt, for my mom, for my grandparents who are no longer here.
Jen, thanks so much. This has been a really remarkable and powerful conversation.
I feel the same way. I just feel so lucky to have somebody like you asking the questions. This kind of conversation is just so different from any kind of conversation I have had or will have with anyone else. So just thanks for this project. I feel like it's a gift, you know? It's a big gift.
This was a special bonus episode of Family Secrets. As we work on the next season, which will drop in early November, keep an eye and an ear out for more special bonus content. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.